the money stuff that you ask contractors when you're first interviewing them from those marketing agencies to just throw.
Perseverance, right? Like when a lot of, when we're persevering
longer
right?
than a lot of dynasties, longer than a lot of country.
You're listening to the Roofing Success Podcast, a show created to inspire roofing contractors to achieve optimal success in their roofing businesses. I'm the host, Jim Aline, the co-author of the books Internet Marketing for Roofing Contractors and The Best Known Roofer. I'm also the co-founder of Roofer Marketers, the leading digital marketing agency for the roofing industry. On each episode, I sit down with industry leaders to talk about their processes, the lessons they've learned, and how to find success in roofing.
Hey, welcome to another episode of the Roofing Success Podcast. If you haven't, or if you want to do it again, hit that the like button, the subscribe button, comment, any of those things. Leave us a review. My phone number, this number right here, it's in the description. Shoot me a text. Tell me what's up. Say how things are going. Tell me if you've learned anything from the episodes. I've gotten a couple of texts recently that I've been, it's pretty cool. Today, we have Connor Rodich with us. How's it going, man?
Going good, man. Thanks for having me, Jim. Awesome. Appreciate it, man.
You've been, is it coaching and consulting in the industry for years now? We've, you know, run into each other at every other trade show event and all across time, man. So it's been a long time coming, man. I appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, it's been good to catch up at those events. I know we've had some plans to do the podcast, so it's good to finally make that happen. But yeah, been on this side of things, on the consulting side for a minute, you know, also simultaneously running roofing companies and doing things. It's been absolute madness for the last half a decade for sure. But yeah, so we're here and it's good to finally get on the podcast. So
thanks, yeah, definitely, man. So for people who don't know who you are, give us a little background, your company and all that type of stuff.
Yeah. So who I am from a personal side of things, like just to give you a little bit of background. So I started off in roofing in late 2018. I actually knew some guys in the industry. I haven't been in it super long, obviously. So, you know, we're in 2024 now. So it's been close to 5 years, but started in that and had a roofing company out in Oklahoma and knew some guys in the industry. I actually was good friends with a guy that's based out of Denver and kind of let me know a little bit about the industry when I was from corporate America, and essentially found my way into roofing after I had a tenant of mine actually at the time that was in one of my rental houses that moved from Omaha, Nebraska to move to Oklahoma City. And we got along, you know, we were both a little younger, and he's like, you know, hey man, have you ever thought about running a roofing company or opening a roofing company at some point? I was like, well, I actually have thought about getting involved in it, but I said, I've never really had the opportunity present itself where it made sense. Like, I'm still doing my corporate thing. Life's good. You know, banking cash every year and hoping to be able to kind of advance in that career. I knew that it probably wasn't going to be the place that I would land ultimately, because it's hard to kind of, you know, elevate and get into CEO positions at a young age or things like that, where you're really calling the shots. But yeah, so I had a guy approach me that was staying in my rental property, and that's what kind of got it all started. And then he moved in to do a partnership deal, and I should have known better, but I was just naive. I didn't know the industry at all. So I didn't know the personalities or the type of things that people say, you know, but he was like, you know, hey, I had this partnership deal fall through, and would you like to do it? I'm like, yeah, sure. So fast forward to today. I, and that partnership's over now, but you know, we had a really, really successful first couple years. You know, we were on pace doing, about $6 million in revenue year two. And we really started, like, we were juicing up. We were working mostly storm stuff, but we had built out a pretty good service model for, realtors and, you know, doing just some of those things. And then I ended up moving to Greenville, South Carolina in 2020. I joined up with Hunter Ballou and did the RoofCon thing for a little while and did some of that stuff with him and the great roofing.com team we had. And then just kind of moved a little bit. Some people have seen me go from being involved in leading that deal and launching Revolt, doing all the different stuff. That was like my first time being in the consulting side of things. You know, it wasn't something that I ever thought, like, if you had had a gun to my head in 2019, said, tell me what the next few years of your life looks like, it would not have been being a consultant. But it just kind of landed that way. And, you know, and it's worked out well. I I'm very privileged now. I've worked with over 130 companies in the last 4 years. I think I've been in more than 30 states. So I've gotten a pretty good landscape of how folks operate in retail models and insurance models and commercial businesses, service-based businesses. So I've seen a lot. There's and I know we'll talk about that a little bit here in a minute, but there's definitely systematic truths and things that businesses fundamentally don't do well in this industry. And I'm going to talk about some of those things today, obviously, but we right now, so executive partners, kind of fast forwarding to today, executive partners, we officially launched in August. It's been a newer venture. I had, a very good experience working alongside Randy Brothers for about a year and a half's time. You probably know about that. So did that for a minute, but launched EP in August of last year. So we haven't even quite been on, a year's time yet. And we've had a lot of, good success. We've had a lot of clients that have, been, it's funny how like folks kind of follow you a little bit as time goes. So I've had some people that were with me when I kind of first started in the industry, and then we kind of went our separate ways, and then they found their way back to me. And we have a mixed bag. I mean, we've got clients anywhere between, let's say our smallest client is doing about $4 million a year, and our largest is doing around $25 million. And so, we really specialize in this, like, I'm all for the solopreneur. I'm all for the growing entrepreneur. I'm all for equipping them with good, foundational knowledge to get them from, starting a business to their first $2 or $3 million. It's super important, right? But the place where I think I can offer the most value, and the team that we have at EP that I feel like we service the most value, is in that like $4-5 million. I mean, we can work with those, down into the threes and twos, but really like that $4-5 million sweet spot, and then up to about the 10 figure mark, because that's where we can get you from those, $5-10 million ranges into that $15-25 million or whatever, like that's kind of our bread and butter. And yeah, and it's has a lot more to do with like building a well-rounded business. We're not bro scalers. We don't love like the whole, like, just, be cash poor and profit poor, but we're going to throw up big numbers on the board. I'm doing that podcast at the end of April. We'll talk about that too, but talk about the seven figure profit chase. Keyword profit, right? Because everybody's all focused on eight-figure revenues and all this different stuff. That's a very quick breakdown. I know it was a little bit long, but hopefully I gave you a good background there. And I got a beautiful wife. I got two kids. Live in Greenville, South Carolina still, and I lived inside state lines of Oklahoma for the first 29 years of my life or whatever it was. So I was an Okie to the end, but then I decided that I wanted to come to the Blue Ridge Mountains here in the upstate of South Carolina, and it's been good to me. So that's kind of a little bit about me.
Good place to raise some kids out there.
Yep.
Yeah. Good, man. Yeah. That's awesome. We talked about, like, you kind of alluded to some of the things that you guys do, and it's, what it made me think of is, you have that startup phase, right? That 2 million, maybe 2 million, maybe getting into the 3 million. Boy, that to me, that there's a lot of hustle in there, right? Yep. It's not a lot of it may not be a lot of systems and processes and business strategy, right? But then you get into that $4-5 million range, and all of a sudden there's people. Mm-hmm. You got, like, all of a sudden we got some people we got to take care of. We got to, like, there's these different decisions to make, right? Now there's some overhead. Now there's, there's payrolls that need to be met. There's a lot of other considerations. So I can see how with what you guys do, that focus, like that's a good kind of measurement, right? Because from our conversations, like, you guys really focus on operations, you focus on the financial acumen of the company, and focus on that leadership. And so let's start by talking about operations and enhancing operations. So let's just, for people that are moving out of that startup phase into that kind of, I guess, what would we call it? I would call it a scale phase, right? Like, you have, the way I look at it is startup scale significance. That's the way I always frame it. Cool. You don't have to frame it the same way. No, you know what I mean? But like that's kind of how I've always framed it. And so startup, right? You have your startup phase and you're getting everything going. You're learning, you're figuring out your company, you're figuring out yourself. You're learning what you're best at. You're out there grinding. And then all of a sudden it's like, boy, we got to make this into a business. Yeah. Just to go off on a little tangent, one of my favorite books is The Cash Flow Quadrant, Robert Kiyosaki. Have you read that one?
Yeah, it's a good right? book.
So it's that, it to me, it's the move from the S quadrant to the B quadrant, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so let's start there. What are some of the things, like, if you're moving from that, you know, from that startup phase into the next phase, what are some of those core foundational operational things that you would recommend people get in place?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And before, just to kind of piggyback on your little, you know, scale, your saying you had there. So we call it startup, perseverance, set, scale, exit, the five phases of business.
There you go.
Startup and perseverance, we usually like to catch businesses when they're going through more of the perseverance phase. The startup phase is great, but like you said, it's a ton of hustle, right? The perseverance phase is where it's like we're finding our identity. We're figuring out how to manage cash flow. We're figuring out how to, you know, really build some of the bones to the business, right? And so our slogan, set, scale, exit, that's where that comes from. So it's the idea of setting with viability to the business, like getting it to where it's financially sound, operationally fit, all these things, right? And then getting it to a place where you decide, like, what is the next step with the business? Because not everybody is meant to scale. Like, not everybody truthfully is. So some people are better in that position. Going back to some of that quadrant conversation where it's like, hey, we're in a good spot. We sit in kind of this like cash cow category, or we're like in a position where we have the ability to like kind of stay the course and not really have massive scaling efforts, and we can sustain healthy profits, right? Some businesses are built to scale. Some of them are in those positions where they're trying to do the private equity plays, or they're trying to like exit their business, right? And that's kind of what I was getting at there. But where the scaling efforts, it's like what I try to tell people is when you set, you're setting for success, but it's not always necessarily to scale, because scaling is another decision. Scaling is a decision that you have to make that is intentional. And I think everybody talks about scaling, like it's like, oh, that's just something that happens with business. Sure, to a degree, but true scale, like when you're actually either taking on outside funding or you're doing things that are really aggressive, it's almost like starting your business over again, because you're putting more people in, you're getting more money involved. I mean, you guys have gone through some stuff like with partners or, you know, people purchasing you. So you know that, like, there's a lot of things that have to take place, in order to make that happen, right? So just to kind of start there, I wanted to kind of mention that first, but that's a great point that you made, and I love that. So,
To comment on one of the things you said, like, there's the why, right? Like, it comes down to the why, right? Of the scale or not scale. Scaling is intentional. I was listening to a podcast recently, and they were talking about the oldest business in the world, and it's a business in Japan that builds the temples there. And they're a couple thousand years. It's a couple thousand year old business that does, I think it was like $30-40 million a year.
Right? Longer than a lot of dynasties, longer than a lot of country.
So just to make a point to people is the growth factor, it does not have to mean longevity, right? And sometimes it doesn't mean longevity. It might mean that you're just breaking everything and it's falling apart, right? So if you are going to move into that scale, you know, phase, or if that's something that you choose to do, be intentional about it, right? Be intentional about it. I'll let you take it from there.
So to answer your question originally, I just wanted to go into that little bit of detail on the five phases of the business, because I wanted to kind of hit it hard out the gate. As far as operationally speaking, you know, there's definitely a lot of things that we see that are missing, right? Our industry is flooded with different models, different business models, different ways that people operate. So it's certainly not a one size fits all. Like, you can't go into a market, and I love people that have written books. You know, Randy's written a book, and who else? Martin Pettigrew. Yeah, I was just saying, like, you heard these guys, right? And like, they write great, you know, books around like the process by which you should follow that should replicate you success. But the truth of the matter is, is there's no one true model, right? Everybody has a different way that they get business done. And I think it depends on a lot of factors, whether you are a retail outfit or insurance outfit or whatever, right? There's a lot of different things, you know, that goes into that. But as far as the truths that we find that lack inside this industry, like we, again, have worked over with over 130 companies we've worked with, these are always the things that we see. And obviously we'll get into some of the financial stuff as well, but the operation specifically, it's like most people have no clue what their true roles and responsibilities are to the business. That's like the number one thing that we see, which I know is, you know, a big thing that's been, I think, amplified lately because of like all the EOS that's integrated into our business and stuff like that. But the truth of the matter is like, that is the number one thing that we go into businesses. It doesn't matter if they're a $5 million, $15 million company, and they seem to be having some profits and success and things like that. It's always this like scattered mess of like who does what and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's the first thing. The next thing is interdepartmental communication. That's definitely a big piece that misses because we have people that, you know, run cradle to grave models with their sales, or they do like different things. And the fact of the matter is if you're truly going to get in a position where you're going to be able to have a business viable and doing well in terms of profits and running well as a business and happy customers and happy people inside the business, you have to understand how the system works out in terms of how you communicate internally. So a lot of times it's like, yeah, we sign this job and we have the price of the job, hopefully, and we have, you know, a little small speck of what this is or an eagle view, and then it's kick it off to production. It's like, whoa, that's not how this works, right? So a lot of times we see that, and then what we have to end up doing is going in and like building in job checklists and like things that people need to make sure that they have set up to make sure that they're not, you know, the number one thing that fails in our business is that sales to operation pass off. So when we see that, which again happens at larger scale companies too. But when we see that, it's like, that's one of the first things that we do is we go in and we literally map out from the time that they take a lead from the marketing stuff that you guys obviously do for them, that they generate a lead and they qualify that lead and they lead source that lead and they do all that stuff, right? To the fully paid and closed, to even post close, which a lot of people don't think about, which is like review collection and gifting and customer referrals and all the other things, right, that you can do. But like we capture from the beginning to the end of what that looks like. And we have to be very intentional with that because that interdepartmental communication and structure and process is always lacking. There's always a part that breaks, and it's usually it's always, in most cases, sales to production. Something is not right, but it's always little pieces inside of the business that aren't perfect, you know?
Those darn salespeople, they're all...
Yeah. 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 From those marketing agencies, you're just throwing...
Oh, that's right. Just throw it in. Throw it in. Got to go get another one.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah,
go ahead. No, I was going to ask, what's do you guys do an exercise that like, you know, or is it just like, okay, let's just go through your customer journey, like from start to finish and really get detailed in the stages? Is that what someone could do?
Yeah. So one of the things that we implement, so with roles and responsibilities, we actually have a 4-quadrant exercise we've run, funny enough, where we talk about like, what is your fulfillment? What's your, we talk about fulfillment, contentment, sacrifice and misery. So we kind of want you to kind of get your bearings of like you as a person, especially as a leadership team or an owner. It's like, we need to first identify, like, how do we get you to what I say is, how do we get you to the top left, which is your fulfillment? Like, how do we get you to where you are most valuable to your business and where we can get it to a place where the rest of your team, and the way that we hire, and we can get into some more details around that stuff, but like, how do we hire, when to hire, and all these different things, who to hire, what makes sense, right? And what are the gaps that exist inside of our business? And so that's kind of the thing we do there. As far as the as far as the process-driven stuff and the stuff that's talked about more of that interdepartmental communication. Yeah. So basically we start off with like a high-level template. And then once we have that workflow template, and a lot of this stuff we also will do inside of like Job Nimbus or some of those software that you can really map out your workflows well, we actually start there. And then what we do is we actually, like, as silly as it sounds, we just get into a Google Doc and we'll literally be mapping that out. And we're like, okay, what is what is done for this stage, and like, what are the things that have to occur in order for us to say, this is done, we're moving this prospect or client to the next place, right? And so, in understanding that sounds, you know, obviously very basic, but then once we understand that, then we can go in and we can automate what we can automate, and we can, you know, process all the things we can process. And then we get all of that moving, and it's like, okay, what are the last bit of variable? Well, that's going to be just the human element, right? There's some things that like you just have to make sure that you're doing. And so that's when we create those checklists, right? And that's when we start making sure that those things are in place. So hopefully that gives you some substance. That's literally like how we build that out, you know? And the third thing I didn't get to, which is something that's kind of related to our second point, but the third thing that we find all the time is the company's vitals. Like, we know that businesses have like very, very essential, like when you go to the doctor's office and you go in for a checkup, well, what are they doing? They're taking your blood pressure. They're taking your heart rate, your oxygen levels, all that sort of stuff. So it's the same thing inside of business. We're looking at it. We're going, okay, what are the key things that we know across the board? Cash on hand management, how are we recognizing deposit payments? What's our accounts receivable? What's our accounts payable? What type of gross profit margin aggregate are we running? Like, these are things we have to know. And so those are the first things that we find almost immediately are missing. And we plug those holes right away. And then obviously we start getting into some more of the like strategic side or some of the other operational things that might not be in place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And that's a good segue into kind of having a conversation about that financial acumen. Like, you have to know your numbers, right? It's unfortunate how many conversations I've had with contractors where I've asked them very simple financial questions.
Yeah.
What is your gross revenue to date?
Yeah.
And what is your profit margin? What's your net profit on that? What's your gross profit? Like, where are you setting your margins? What are you set? Like, how are you marking up this? How are you marking? And it's very simple things that along the way, they just get lost, right? Like, and I think that a lot of times, you know, when you're going through that, how did you put it? What was it? Set per the one that started with the P.
Yeah, no, it was startup. So startup is first phase, perseverance.
Perseverance.
And then, yeah.
Perseverance, right? Like when we're persevering a lot of times, man, it's like stuff's hitting the fan. Like we, you know, so a lot of the focus gets reactionary, right? And then we lose focus on those things that we should have intention about. So let's walk through, you know, kind of what does a healthy company look like in terms of these metrics? What would you say? And of course it differs, you know, residential, commercial, you know, storm restoration, retail, like, of course there's going to be variances there. Maybe we could just speak to one of those or however you want to, you know.
No, that's a good question. I mean, yeah. And some of the things you said a second ago, around like, you know, the money stuff that you ask contractors when you're first interviewing them or, you know, trying to understand more about their business. It's funny, and I'm not saying this to be misleading to like, so if you have someone answers that question, Jim, to, you know, say, hey, I'm doing $5 million a year. Well, that's an open-ended question because, in my opinion, being a financial guy, because I'm going, okay, what are we talking about? Are we talking about booked business? Are we talking about accrual revenue? Or are we talking about cash revenue? Because those are all three different things.
That's
something that, like, I've worked with businesses before, truthfully. Like, I'm actually about to take on another client that's this type of person. I mean, he's signing in sales about $45 million a year in work because he's in insurance, right? But he's only producing about $25 million of that work, which I know sounds crazy, but because he's got some that are big insurance jobs, he's got some that are like large loss that takes a long period of time. Sometimes he's doing deals that just literally fall through. Like, he'll have some big contracts that he writes for $5 to $10 million for these high-end re-roofs and or whatever the case may be, and then they just don't work out, right? So you can have, and not to say that it's like that every year. I'm just saying like that historically happened. And so like there might be some years where he sells $45 million and he produces 40. And there might be some that he builds, you know, he does $45 million again in sales and does 25, whatever, right? And that discrepancy is, some people are like, wow, that's crazy. But it's like, it can happen, especially if you're in insurance. Now, retail is a little different, of course, but But yeah, that's, it can be the same thing too, where you're selling something that gets booked as, you know, as revenue that you've booked the business and sold, but you don't recognize that revenue until, you know, even accrually, you don't recognize it until 6 to 12 months later, whatever the case may be, if it's a larger job. So there's circumstances like that that happen all the time. And I'm going to answer your question, but I just kind of wanted to start there too, is like, financially speaking, it's not just about like, all right, what's my P&L look like? Yeah, that's important. Your profit loss income statement, super important to know. You know, you need to have your balance sheet put together too. I argue that the balance sheet is more valuable than a P&L because it really gives you the whole configuration of the business as a CFO. Like, that's how I look at things. But in budgets and all those things are very important. But like, at the core of the matter, it's like, we need to first establish like, what is the language that we're using and what we're talking about when we're talking about these things. Because roofers, with all due respect, most of them did not come from a corporate background like I did, right? And most of them, a lot of them don't have formal financial education. So they have to learn what they learn by doing, which is not a bad thing. But they also, I think, and a lot of times I've spoke on stages or things like that, and I get people come up to me afterwards and they're like, this was the first time that I've ever been able to understand what financial education looks like and financial acumen looks like in my business, because it's overwhelming. There are a lot of things, and there's huge discrepancy between the CPA, the bookkeeper that you sometimes have and should have, but bookkeepers are, I mean, they, to be honest, both CPAs and bookkeepers are like, there's really good ones and there's really bad ones and there's everything in between, right? So, but you have CPAs, you've got bookkeepers, and then you've got people like myself or the owners, right? That are people that are like tied up in this mix where they're like, I care about my taxes getting filed. I care about my books being in order, but I, as an owner, care about very few things. Like, I want to know where my money is. I want to know how quickly it's, you know, or how long it's taking me to get that money. I want to know, like, there are very vitally important metrics, which is getting to your question now. So that's why, like, as I take you on that journey, the point is like, it's important to first establish like, what's the language? What is the information? So like, and that's a big piece that we have to educate people on when we first start working with them, because they just don't know. They just simply have either gotten bad advice or they don't understand that stuff. So, so getting the question, the main figures, I told them a second ago, but like, the ones that are consistently, and I know people are like, oh, what, you know, cash on hand and, you know, sure, I know what's in the bank. Well, there's, especially when you're running a high clip, you know, you're a $3-5 million business or more, there's money in, money out every single day, or at least there most of the time is, unless you're working like just one large commercial deal or something, you know, like that. There's money going in and money going out. So it's like tracking that and having the pulse on that on a weekly basis and having a weekly financial review. We look at your cash on hand totals. We look at your deposits, what you've collected. A lot of companies take in deposits and then they will account that as cash on hand, when in reality, that is not a cost incurred. It's not a cost of goods sold incurred item. Like, you have not produced anything. So technically, by accounting specification, that's a liability on the balance sheet. So if you were to have to zero out your business and, you know, you couldn't produce that work, right, you would have to return that money, or else it's obviously going to go to probate or something else. Like, it would not be something that you've incurred, right? You have not earned that, or that earning of revenue, right? So those are the first two things, is we need to figure out cash on hand and your deposits incurred and how much you've taken in from customers, so that we can prevent this Robin Peter to pay Paul stuff that we see all the time, unfortunately. And then accounts receivable and accounts payable. Running accounts receivable and accounts payable, well, accounts receivable inside your CRM is more than likely overstated. And I'll tell you the reasons why really quickly, without getting into too much detail. The accounts receivable figures that you run inside of your report softwares through whatever CRM you're using, it's not sufficient, because there is a large element of overstatement because of the fact that people are invoicing for things that, again, have yet to be built, or they have invoices that are open that have not yet been put together, right? And so when they have not actually incurred the work and there is an open invoice in that system, it's going to automatically generate a receivable report for them. And that's one of the biggest things that I see all the time, is it's like, where is my money? And they're like looking at their accounts payable, accounts receivable ratio, and they're like, oh, well, I have $500,000 on receivable and I only owe my supplier $100,000. So I'm $400,000 in the clear, but I'm broke. why? Well, so then I do a little bit more research. And I'm like, you have a $250,000 worth of overstatement, brother, and you're not keeping it, you're whatever, you know? So there's a lot of things that can happen there when you rely on those types of systems. And then accounts payable being the fourth thing. If you don't know what you owe through your vendors and your crews, and one of the big things we see all the time too, and this is why you see postponed cap outs or things that are inhibiting companies from paying out their commissions, is because they don't think about that. They owe the commission and it is a part of their accounts payable, their bill entry, but they don't do that. And then they realize, oh crap, I owe, you know, 50 grand or whatever it is on that next payroll or couple of payrolls. And they realize that that's not, they thought they had the profits that they don't have. You understand what I'm saying? So yeah. Those are four really critical things. I think the other things, just to kind of sum this up, and I'll get back to letting you share, Jim, but is gross profitability margin. Like if you don't know that, you got to figure that out. Like if you don't know what you're actually grossing aggregately across all your business that you do, and you're not job costing, then that's a problem, right? You need to figure that out. And then the other thing is, I see this all the time, is like, what is your actual break even of the business? Like, what is your operating expense running every month? That would, I would say that was probably like the sixth thing that I would reference. And I'll recap here for folks listening, because I know I've gone through this quick, but operating expense or figuring out what that break even is. Like when you're spending every month and you're looking at it through that lens and you're figuring out, you know, hey, I've got $60,000, and I literally do this with my clients. I have my phone in my pocket, so I'll show you. I'm like, if I can figure out that I'm doing $60,000 per month in operating expense, right? Or that's what I'm, you know, what it costs to keep the lights on and run my business, right? And I know that I have a gross profitability margin of 35%, let's say, then all I do is just take that number, divide it by 0.35, and that gives me my break even, right? And that's something that like a lot of people, I'll sit up on stage and do that. I'll be like, if you know your overhead and you know your gross profit margin, I can give you something extremely powerful today without even having to talk to anybody else that says, if you're doing less than $171,000 in cash earned in the business, right? When you're bringing that revenue in cash, then you are losing money. And it's important for you to know that, right? It's important for you to know that the needle is moving in the wrong direction there, right? So now if you're selling $500,000 a month, but we're only billing that at, you know, $250,000 a month, then like, hey, there's probably going to be some good things coming down the road. But again, that's where we talk about billing and being efficient with all that stuff. So not to try to go all the way down that road, but like those are the six things: cash on hand, deposits on hand, accounts receivable, accounts payable, gross profit margin, and knowing where your break even is. Those are the six things I would say. If you knew those things, then that would change your entire business.
Yeah, those are some great points there. Some of the things like the deposits incurred, like deposits, that was, I think that's an aha moment for a lot of people, because that just goes in the bank account and then it looks like cash on hand, right? Like it's just, and so making sure that that's differentiated, and then the accounts payable on the sales rep's commission, boy, that's a problem in this industry, right? Because that has been known to not be paid on from time to time, right? And so not treating it as such. And that's, I mean, that kind of gets down to, you know, you had mentioned like the financial education and the different languages of accounting, and you have your cash accounting and you have your accrual accounting. And so the things that you're speaking in, the language that you're speaking in here is more accrual accounting. And so just for a simple differentiation to, you know, explain the differences between the two and why I would say, like, when you frame this and when you're putting it together, this is why we do it this way. This is why we use this language and not that language.
Yeah. So that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because a lot of people don't even know that. And that's important to know, right? And a lot of people, it's truthfully, they're like, this sounds so confusing because my CPA told me and they got the degree and they have their own business maybe as a business owner, as a private CPA or private, you know, entity CPA, but they have never run a roofing company, or, you know, we don't have that type of background. So as simple as I can put it, right, is cash, in the way we recognize it from an accounting standpoint, is money that is actually exchanged at the time of cash in or cash out. So when you're looking at a report that says cash, that means literally what has been exchanged in revenues to that account or incomes to that account and expenses to that account. So whenever you have a bank account that has $250,000 going in it in a month and $200,000 going out of it in a month, that is cash accounting. That's literally as simple as I can make it. Okay. Accrually speaking, which you're right, Jim, the things I was mentioning do allow you to get into accrual accounting. And that's something that I've actually been on stage before and had someone tell me like, I can't believe that you said that cash accounting is, you know, important and you should have all your businesses running on accrual accounting. For the record, I have all of my businesses running on accrual accounting. They file cash, which is another key point. If I had to ever advise you on anything, you should run your books on accrual, but file your taxes in cash, which we can get into later. I'm not a CPA, but that's how our businesses run. But the accrual side, so it's when it's incurred, right? So, that's a very, very key point. A lot of people will sit there and go, well, I have this $1 million accounts receivable, or I have this astronomical, you know, accrual revenue, right? Well, what is that? That is actually, if you haven't actually produced a product, this is super important. If you have not actually produced a product to a customer, serviced them with a roof, ripped off the first shingle or whatever you're doing, and the work has been incurred, that is not booked revenue. And I'm sorry to tell you that. This is not booked revenue. Now, a lot of people will account for it whenever they take deposits. That's okay as long as we understand what is in deposits, right? Now, I don't look at it through the lens of, I'm not trying to make this confusing because I want to get like very simply to the answer around accrual, but I have to be clear with this, that accrual is the easiest way I could say it is understanding more into the future of what your business looks like, right? So that's the purpose of accrual. So when you look at your accounts receivable and your accounts payable, that's considered an accrual accounting, right? All of the assets and all the liabilities and all of the things that you look at through the lens of where you're, that's why I look at balance sheets a lot, right? Is I want to know exactly where my business is when all the dust settles, right? And that's why the accrual accounting piece is super important, because that's what it lets you in on, with the small caveat of a lot of people that come to me, they go, yeah, we're running accrual accounting or we do that. And they have $1 million of open invoices, but they've only produced $200,000 of that. I go, guys, that's sales. It's important to understand that sales and there's accrual, right? And sales is not whenever you, as soon as you sell it and even if you exchange a hefty deposit, right? That needs to sit there and that needs to be recognized as a deposit. Once the work is incurred, then that's whenever our accounts payable, our accounts receivable incur. That's whenever we start the process. And then that's truly accrual accounting. I know it's a long spin, but that's like literally to a T exactly what it is.
But that, you know, it's when the product is delivered. So every contractor listening has had a contract canceled. Yep. And if you haven't, you just haven't done business long enough, right? Yeah. Like that's what it, but if you collected that deposit, I'm just trying, you know, like if you collected that deposit and you have to return that deposit, but you put it on your books, it's not really your money. So until that job is produced, until the revenue is you, that's when it's looked like that the revenue is yours now, because the, mm-hmm. you have done your part of the work, not just, taking some money. So now we've,
you know, hopefully that was clear though. I know it was a lot of stuff, Jim, but no, it's a lot
of stuff. Accounting is one of those things, man. Like it is definitely a language within itself, but then now you know, there's dialects in that language too, right? There's so much to it. And a real, you know, a true CFO will look at things differently than your CPA. Then we'll look at it like your bookkeeper, right? There's different viewpoints from, you know, looking at your books. There's different things that you can look at, but there's some key things that are consistent on a day in and day out basis. And that, you know, you have to actually get the money. You have to complete the job, get the money in hand, pay your people, and have profitability at the end of it. Yep. Because if you don't have real true profitability, it's very easy to see that cash in the bank and just be like, oh, we're good. But you don't see, you know, I mean, if you
I have a story about someone that like running a pretty sizable company, they're running about $5 million operation. And they hadn't been updating their pricing to keep up to market standards. They're running in a retail market. And legitimately, I walked in their business. They thought they were doing good. They're wondering why cash flow is down. They're wondering why things are happening. They were running their margins at a place where essentially they were just breaking even their business with their overhead, and they had no idea. And it's because they literally were not job costing and looking at the jobs on a job to job basis. And they didn't also know. I mean, they knew relatively because they set that pricing, right? But they set that pricing 2 years ago or a year and a half ago before pricing increases were rampant. And then once we got a hold of them, I like literally looked them in the face. I go, brother, the reason you're cash poor is because you literally have no, like, not only is cash flow down, because cash and profit are two different things, but cash is down, but profit is like literally you're doing jobs for basically to do it for $0 because you're doing it with your overhead being incurred. So we've seen that like at larger scale, not just the company that's running $1 million op. Like we're talking about $5 million company with, you know, 4 or 5 employees that's like, and they're like, why am I not making money? And I'm like, okay, well, let's open the hood on this a little bit. Let's take a look. And it wasn't, you know, one of the God-given gifts I have is just being able to take like 5-10 minutes and figure it out. Now, a lot of people aren't wired like that because they don't have the CFO mind and haven't had the experience, and that's totally fine. But like, it didn't take but a few minutes, and I'm starting to run numbers and look at their books. And even though they were abysmal, I'm still able to figure out like, where is their operating expense at? And like, where are they looking at over the last, you know, 10 to 15 jobs? And it was literally a break even. And that's what people just, I mean, they think they're doing good, right? They see the big checks, like you said, all that stuff, and it's just not always the case. So
I think that there's a correlation here between what you're doing on the operations side and building that intentionality through the stages of your business. If you look at there's stages of your finances, right? You have your labor, you have your materials, you have your overhead, you have all these things, and you have to put some thought into it and say, okay, this is where our labor is. This is where our materials are. This is what I want at the end of the day. Like, this is what I want to make, right? And it can't be too out of alignment with the market conditions, right? If you want to run a roofing company on 50% net profit, that you're probably not going to be able to do that. So you do have to have proper expectations in the net profit that you're able to get to. Yep. But then you're benchmarking with your financials and you can job cost. You know, you could take it from a macro level and just look at all of your revenue over a specific time period and break it down. Are we hitting our net profit, goals? Yep. But then, you know, if you to get very intentional about it, it's on a job by job basis, right? You can really be granular and make sure and ensure that you have a profitable business and things don't get out of control. Cause boy, they could get out of control quick, right? Yep. They can get out of control quick.
Yeah. So we, that's all good stuff. And one more tangent, I promise, then we can pivot. This is, it's funny you say this, because this is literally the fabric of how we build our businesses financially. So when we do budgets and we do annual planning and all these things, right? We don't even talk about what the revenue target is until I understand what their net profit mission is, right? Yeah. So if I am an owner, and this is some stuff that you just have, you don't know unless you know, but this is like, I'm trying to give away as many gold nuggets as I can to this, like where I can say, hey, this is literally how we do things. Now, as far as the implementation, that's where a lot of people are like, I get lost there and I need help, right? But I'm telling you, if you can execute this is how it works, okay? There is a configuration and an equation with how much you need to do in revenue based on what your net profitability target is, okay? Based on what your operating expense expectation is for the year, and then based on what your gross profitability aggregate percentage is, okay? And that number, I have a formula deal that I use, but it literally will tell you what your revenue target should be given that those things are consistent, right? Now, there's certainly modifications to that. We can say, hey, you know, the numbers told me I need to do $6 or $7 million in revenue, but I want to focus on 10. Great, that's cool. But like the core focus of how we build this business is going to be based on what profitability are we trying to achieve. So our profits, like when we track our stuff, we track gross profit on every single job. We look at that on a monthly basis. And then we look at our net profitability most of the time on a quarterly basis. We can do things and get in the weeds a little bit more. It's just a little bit hard sometimes to be able to look at that on a month-to-month basis. So, but we look at that on that basis. And a lot of it is just looking at it in comparison to what we built out when we build their budgets. Like once we set all this up, we're literally pulling our budget reports and looking at this. So the important thing when we're talking about the net profitability of your business and all the stuff that you just brought up, Jim, I think at the end of the day, you know, when we look through the way to calculate that and really get clarity on that, it's not just as simple as like net profitability is $100,000 and that's what we're going to earn and that's what we're going to bring home. It doesn't work like that, right? The biggest piece that I have to remind people is Uncle Sam, you got a business partner that you never wanted to have. So you got to remember that Uncle Sam's at play and you got to know that there's going to be a tax implication on how you perform. And the other thing you got to remember too is in that $100,000 example I gave, you know, you're going to be giving some of that, if not in all of that, in most cases, if it's only $100,000, should be staying in the business, right? We should be having retained earnings to the business and keep that money to keep things going. So, you know, that's the biggest thing with configuring all this and talking about, you know, how should that entire financial equation work? And that's one of the biggest things that we do with working with our clients and helping them navigate that, you know, because there's a lot of companies and we are privileged that you talked about some of the net profit percentages, like they're probably a bit irrational, but I had some people look at me like crazy eyes when I tell them I've had some clients that we can get net profits with like pretty well sized companies, pretty large companies running north of 25%. Yeah. It's not easy, but it's possible. And, you know, the majority of our businesses, all of our businesses, we want them to run at least 10%, but our goal is to be 15 or more. Right. And all of that's very possible, but very few people really know what they're truly profiting. You know what I mean?
For sure. And once you have a business, I think that there's a point in time in business where it all turns to people, yeah. Right? And I know that you guys work a lot on like leadership development and building leadership teams and speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. One of the things I said, I actually just put together a little email campaign and recorded a video for it. And the first thing I said that is like the forgotten thing in this industry when they're people hire, you know, sales coaches, they hire marketing agencies, they hire folks like me, they hire whatever. Okay. It is your people. If you don't have the right people or you have people that don't align to the culture that you have yet to even identify at times, like there's some people that don't really have that like curated culture and understand what they're really looking for. It's the number one thing that will lead you to disaster. You can have all the operational efficiency, all the financial acumen, all the marketing, all the sales, all the things working. And if you don't have good people and understand that people are what lead you to your profit that you desire, it's not going to work, right? So that's, the leadership component, it's huge. We really coach on helping folks become better leaders and understanding the type of leader that they are. Because I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, and there's certainly principles that you have to learn as a leader. You got to learn to have difficult conversations. You got to learn how to be able to handle criticism. And I'm not even the best at that. But I think anybody that you talk to will say, like, you got to be able to learn how to be better and learn how to get better as a leader, right? I think that there are certainly fundamental pieces that if you can't have that hard or difficult conversation, or you can't lead from the front, or you can't be that type of leader, there are things you need to implement for sure. But then there are also people that are certain types of leaders, right? And some are more vocal, some are more by doing, some are more by, you know, leading from sales or leading from the subject matter expert side. Like there's a lot of different, you know, you can be your own person, you know, you have to certainly carry those vital and really inarguable attributes that you have to be a leader. But overall, like you can kind of find your place. And so that's one of the biggest things that we do. It kind of ties back to that four quadrant thing I was talking about earlier, where we really want to get you in your fulfillment place. We want to really know what like you absolutely hate and what makes you miserable with this business. Because not everybody, most everybody, I would say 99.9% of people don't love everything about this business. Like most people like their area of expertise and like what they feel like they offer the most value in. So, you know, we try to get you in that place and then, you know, really developing your team and being able to incorporate a lot of things that we like to do with, you know, team retreats and unique experiences that can really cultivate culture. And that's something that, you know, we also talk about and work on as well. So, yep.
Yeah. You have to have that culture, you know, as you're growing or just to have a strong business that's going to have longevity. You want to have the people around you, the right people. Another key point that I heard you say was just the things that you're not good at, right? Like you need the people. You're not good at everything, right? Like, or you don't like doing some things. Maybe you're good at it, but it just pains you to do it. You need to know how to lead and delegate and manage that. I know you've been around. I mean, there's a lot of PE activity in the space right now, and you're involved in helping companies get prepared for that. What are some things you're seeing there? How can someone prepare if that's kind of one of their goals?
Yeah. Well, for one, and I know that we're wrapping up here probably, but the private equity conversation is a whole podcast of its own, so I don't want to do it injustice, but I wanted give my quick little rundown of things. I made a video again the other day about this as well, and it's like when you talk about what PE is, the history of private equity, not in our space because it's newer in the industry because of some of the things that they're learning and figuring out since the COVID days. But, private equity, I look at it as like not a good or bad thing. It's there. It's good to have it in the industry, I think, for the sake of folks that are ready to make that jump or are in a position where they can, they're in a major metropolitan. They want to have more financial backing. They've worked really hard to build their business to where it is, and they want to have the exit for themselves and for the people inside the organization for benefiting from that too. And so like there are certainly upside items to private equity being in the space, but there are so much misinformation going around and so many things that are being talked about that are just not true about that, that sector. And I think that, without again going into a lot of detail around that, I think it's important just to say, like, do your research. Know that every private equity company has a very, very similar objective, and they have the objective. And the objective, the main objective of private equity is to return the investment or make a return to their investment, their investor, right, to their high net worth investor. That's just the fact. And so, certainly when you consolidate companies and you talk about some of your bulk purchasing or some of the marketing, abilities or some of these things that bring benefit to an organization that takes part in private equity, it can create a lot more bottom line growth, a lot more profitability across the entire portfolio. The key thing though here is that the prices that private equity is paying for right now and the way in which they're going about their growth strategies is very, it's very much a seller's market. And so if you want to partake in it, do it, but also know that like the wave of it in terms of what you're going to be able to sell for and the amount of marketing they're pumping in and doing all these things to get so much momentum going, that is a very traditional, like cyclical thing. That's like kind of the establishment of private equity. And the goal in almost all cases is within like a 3 to 5 year time to take on a continuation partner or to be able to do something that can help them recapitalize the fund, because that's how they return the investor's payment, right? That's how they create their true return. So yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like it's all good stuff. I think it's just important to have the knowledge about it. I also am not one of those doomsday people. Like I know there's a lot of people that are like, oh, AI is going to take over the world and PE is going to take over the world. And like, I could be completely wrong. So what do I know? But I think at the end of the day, private equity has still several months, if not a few years, to organize. It's a very disorganized effort right now because they're trying to go after the same things. They're trying to get those really nice residential retail strong brand outfits. Everybody's going after the same meat on the bone. There's going to be tons of opportunity to play in it. So don't feel like you're being left out. The multiples might not be as insane as they are, but they're still going to be operating in the space and competing with one another. And I think what it all boils down to, Jim, last thing I want to say about it is is more about the strategy. So it's important when you're doing your research about private equity to understand what the PE strategies are, because the fundamental concept of what they're all trying to do is the same. They're trying to return, they're making a return adequate for their investor. When I say adequate, I mean it's very lucrative. Okay. So at the end of the day, and they care about you. I'm not saying they're doing it disingenuous. Like there's tons of brands that are powered by That's private right. equity. Morgan Stanley's done a ton of deals and Alpine's done a ton of deals and and Freeman Spogli's done a ton of deals. Like the guys that are playing in this, like your household names, you know, Advanced Auto Parts and Petco. And I mean, companies that are very well known, right? So it's not like it's a bad thing. It's just, you have to understand the intention and understand that the key difference amongst all of them is their strategy. Some are wanting to do more, you know, roll back and have you play into the larger holding co. Some of them want to, you know, get you to take their money and run so that way they can hold the retaining, you know, portions. And so it just kind of depends on like what you're really looking for. And I think that to go back to your original question, sorry, I haven't actually answered that. So no, like how to get prepared. So like how to get prepared for that. I think, you know, the way the industry is running right now and the way that private equity is operating, unless you're doing like $1 million of true bottom line, I mean, there are some businesses that are getting across the finish line with, you know, $1 million bottom lines with $500,000 of add back. But truth be told, like if you're not truly operating with like $1 million profit business per year, that they're really not that interested or at least not willing to probably pay you what you're really, what would make it worth your time. So I think if you're like sub that number, right? Like now if you're doing like, and I've said this, like there are some companies I work with that are literally doing $5 million, $6 million that are doing $1 million worth of EBITDA, right? So it doesn't mean you have to be doing eight figures. Eight figures means literally nothing. Remember this if you hear nothing else today. Revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash is reality. So at the end of the day, the revenue really has nothing to do with it. It has a lot to do with like the way that you have operated as a business and set up your business to function without you. So that's one of the biggest things, right? The next thing is that you actually understand the fundamentals of your business from a numbers perspective, all the things we've talked about, okay? Operating in a way where you've integrated technology and automations and like you're moving into the 21st century, right? You're still not working off of sheets of paper and, you know, things like that. Not that some of that's bad. It's just like some of these things require, you know, for you to really rapidly scale, which is their intention to be able to move the business forward, right? And I think the last thing is like, if you're not doing at least $1 million of bottom, then it probably makes sense for you to kind of like get back in the saddle, work on your business, get where you're wanting to go. And then, you know, when PE presents itself as an opportunity, you know, I know there's people getting flooded inboxes that probably make zero money a year and they run a $1 million business. Those people are just, they're just finders. That's all they're doing, right? So the true, like when you really get issued an LOI, and the LOI is also not the end of the day either. There's due diligence that happens. There's a lot of things. You probably know that, Jim. You probably know enough about all the things that, you know, all the skeletons in the closets, all the things that would happen through due diligence, okay? You have to understand that like, that in order to really be the company to be acquired, you have to make sure your business is all the stuff that we've talked about today and that you're producing healthy profits. That's what they want to see. And that's as simple as I can make it, right?
Yeah. And to me, it's de-risking, right? Yep. Like if you, and kind of back to our early point of like moving from that self-employment into business ownership, if you are a self-employed person, there is a lot of risk in someone buying your business because you are the everything, right? If you actually build a business, have true, you know, strong operational acumen, strong financial acumen, you're a leader and have built a leadership team with great profitability, that is the de-risking. And that's what they're looking for, right? Because they don't, you know, it's an investment to them. And none of us want to invest in a risky asset, right? We would much rather have a better, less risky, you know, a better chance at that great return. So, Connor, I appreciate you, man. It's been great. How can people find you, get a hold of you, that type of stuff?
Yeah,
exactly. Webinar coming up.
Yeah, I got the webinar. Yeah. Thanks for giving me my little opportunity to plug. So I got the webinar coming up. It's going to be the seven-figure profit chase. That's going to be April 25th. I think it's at like 11 a.m. Eastern time, 8 Pacific. So I'm going to run that for about an hour and a half and try to talk about all the things we've talked about today and more. And then also, if you're trying to reach out to me, you can reach out. I'm very accessible through Facebook. I think anybody is these days. So Facebook's a great way. Just search Connor Rodich. You'll find me, Connor Rodich. You can't miss it. I'm like the only Connor Rodich because of my last name, not because I'm anything special. And then exec.partners.com. That's going to be the other way to get in touch is exec.partners.com. exec.partners, literally just that, not exec.partners.com. It's just exec.partners. That's the easiest way to get a hold of us as well. And yeah, I'd love to be able to catch up with folks that are interested in, you know, working on getting their business ready to sell or make their business a more viable entity, or, you know, make for better opportunities of the things that are available to you in the marketplace. And the end goal at the end of the day, Jim, with any business we work with, is enhancing the enterprise value and the interpersonal value that goes along with that. You know, we want to build healthy leaders. We want to have healthy teams and happy people inside our organization. We want to have happy customers, and we want to make a lot of money. That's the goal. So
that's right.
That's kind of my quick spiel. Appreciate you letting me be on today. Awesome. And it's been a pleasure. Yeah. And I hope that this has been valuable for the listeners. So
awesome. This has been another episode of the Roofing Success Podcast.
If you would like to generate more revenue through your digital marketing efforts, please visit roofermarketers.com to get a copy of the book, The Best Known Roofer. Also, check the training section of the website for guides on everything from running effective pay-per-click ads to how to properly set up your Google My Business listing. Thanks for listening.